You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, hello again, everyone. This is Doug Thorpe, and you are listening to another episode of Leadership Powered by Common Sense. We're the show that we like to get together with guests who have great experience and helpful tips and hints they can share with you if you are in a position of authority and responsibility and want to be a better leader. My guest today is a gentleman named Joe Davis. He has had his own long run in helping others become better leaders. I'll let him tell more of his story. But Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Doug. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So Joe has had a long run with the company known or the firm known as BCG or Boston Consulting Group, I guess it was once upon a time, right?
Right. Yep.
May still be in legal form. I never looked at that. I don't know. But tell us just in a real quick recap, if you will, Joe, just kind of the journey that got you into this coaching and consulting that you're doing.
Well, yeah. Okay. Real quick. So actually I started off as a P&G sales rep, loved that job and talking about good learning. Matter of fact, at times it was difficult. My wife said, you can't quit. Getting promoted a few times with P&G, and this is 40 years ago, is quite good. Then I went to business school and landed on BCG very happily and very luckily. And, you know, BCG is an up or out place. So I made the first few ups. And then once you get to a point where you're close to, hey, I could work here for a long time, course, you really put your mind to it. And it's been a wonderful career. I think, you know, one thing for me that's kept me in it for quite a long time is just such a variety of, I mean, of course, consulting, but also leadership roles, which just were very inspiring. And to me personally, I'm not sure I could have consulted pure old, good old fashioned consulting for 40 years, but, you know, supporting clients and supporting BCGers and leading has been quite a journey.
So if I may, let me ask you something I often ask my executive coaching clients. Where did you get your fundamental beliefs and ideas about being a leader? Where did those come from?
Well, I think two things. My experiences, of course. I mean, that's, you know, and just actually, I'll even tell a funny story. When I was 24, I was district field rep, my first leadership role at P&G, Procter & Gamble, and had four sales reps, one who's also like young manager track and three who are traditional sales reps. And even thinking through how does a 24-year-old help these, I think they're 35 to 40-year-olds, what do I do for them? They do the job every day. How can I help lead them? You know, that started me on this journey. And I had some lessons there, made a few mistakes along the way, of course, you know, just young buck, never intentional, you know, mean mistakes, but just not very sensitive, which I can talk about if I want. And then at BCG, just over the years, you know, we've been through, you know, multiple different ups and downs, not BCG, but the world, you know, and it affects the people I lead and team with. And then during COVID, you know, that really brought together a lot of pieces of, you know, my sense of what leadership is, which is, you know, of course, driving the business, but it's also, you know, supporting and growing the people.
So let me ask you this. You've obviously got the tenure and experience. Do you think the demand for effective leadership has changed over the decades?
I think the type of leadership has changed over the decades that makes it someone effective. Of course, you had to be effective, you know, whatever it was. But, you know, and I was thinking about this. I mean, there's, of course, you need a leader who someone might, you know, like, what's to say, tough times require a tough leader. I mean, but I'm going to, you know, you always need a leader who can make decisions, be decisive, think about all their stakeholders. I think what's also shifted, though, is that it's not just making tough calls. You also have to inspire and motivate and be there for the people. And I think, you know, whether, I mean, I could go, tell me if I go too deep, but, you know, you think about the impact of technology, it just brought work and personal life quite a bit together. I mean, from the BlackBerry many, many years ago, which you and I both remember, you know, through to the computes, you know, the personal computer, the iPads, the phone, and then Zoom, you know, you're all of a sudden can be on all the time. So the blur of, you know, I'm going to treat you this way at work and I'm going to treat you that way at home, I don't think a leader can pull that off as much anymore if they, you know, separate that completely. And then COVID, you know, brought your living room and your bedroom into the workplace, right? So then you really had to think about, oh, who is this person there? So I think that what's changed is that you need to be, you know, I call it a generous leader, and you also need to be the, you know, the decisive business leader of the past. You, neither one goes away, but both are critical.
Al, I like the way you frame that. I have gone on record. I wrote a blog article on it a few months, but I said, for all those same reasons that you just described, I think what many people think of as the old school command and control in the modern business workplace is pretty much dead. I don't think you can show up as a leader with that mindset, you know, do it my way or take the highway kind of approach, because the whole COVID phenomenon punctuated everybody's sense of mortality. And when now people think of their work, they don't tolerate stuff like that like they once did.
No, I agree. And it's you know, you look at it from two angles. I think if you really want to inspire and motivate people to be helping you grow whatever it is you're growing, or to achieve the mission of your organization, whatever that be, command and control is not going to do it. You know, people are expecting you to see them as a human, you know, no longer a cog in the organization wheel, as you just said. They expect you to understand their not know their lived experience, but at least acknowledge where they're coming from and how they can help. But, you know, so that as well as, but I mean, that's what they're expecting now from the leaders. You know, where's the command and control, as you said? You just can't. But I know, I was going to say that. And then the COVID changed it all, because now we're all so tightly connected, and people can, the best can walk away. And that may not have been, I suppose the best can always walk, but that's the other difference. If you want to retain the best, you have to be treating them as you just said, as you wrote in your blog. That's the other issue. You're just going to lose the best. And I don't think you can really drive business success if you keep losing all your best people. You know, yeah. I just don't think that works.
I'm going to be really blunt. I want to take advantage of some of your experience. I want to bounce an idea off of you, something I've been talking about with clients, but I want to get your yay or nay on it, and please feel free to disagree if you are inclined to do so. My thesis is this. What I say, after all my years of running teams and trying to build businesses, I've come to a conclusion that if you do a pretty good job of hiring the right people, and I know that's a big if, but if you do, those people want to show up every day and do fundamentally the right thing. So as a leader, you have to perpetually, constantly help them understand what a win looks like, what the next right thing is and could be and should be. And if you do so, those people will shine. But if you as a leader fail to provide clarity of that right thing, those good people are fundamentally going to do nothing because they will not do the wrong thing. That runs against their demeanor and wiring and propensity to act. So they will choose to fundamentally just freeze in place. And I tell people, if you come to me and tell me you're not satisfied with what your team's doing, they seem to be stuck, my argument is you probably haven't given them the clarity they need to move forward.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you. Let me just say that. Sorry, if I could disagree with you, we'd have a more robust conversation. I think, you know, you could say the right thing. You also could say, I think people nowadays wanted to be doing a meaningful thing. So it might be both, you know, right. I even think of my career at BCG, if you had consultants writing the slides are going to be in the appendix. And, you know, I'm sorry, we write too many slides. We all know. Then the appendix eventually say, what the heck? I'm not doing anything meaningful. You know, whether it was right or wrong, you could debate, but it's sure not meaningful. Then you start to check out. I think I do think the role, the activity people really now, especially more and more, is this meaningful to something that's going to drive a mission they believe in. And then to your point, it's as you say the right thing, because and you know, are you directing them? Yeah, if the team's stuck or going the wrong way, I don't know who you blame but the leader. I can't see that. That's just who you blame. Now, it's interesting. I was talking to one of my colleagues. You know, I think the other thing maybe we'll get there is that in the command and control being gone, a little bit more, and everybody is different, a little bit more vulnerability, authenticity, and honesty is required. Now, everyone can draw their line in different places, and that may be difficult. I get it. But I had a good friend at BCG who said he used to be afraid to say, "I don't know." And so therefore, if he's sitting there with his team and you could see that people are stuck, he'd leave the room. Well, now, whose fault is it? Now they're just going to sit there stuck. So to your point, and eventually finally said, "Okay, I'll say I don't know." And said, "I don't know either." And it's like the whole room, "Oh, you don't know either? Oh, none of us know." And the energy and the creativity started to just spur about, "Hey, let's all try to figure out, you know, whatever it is we're trying to solve." But everybody was stuck and no one was being vulnerable or honest enough to admit it, and nothing was getting done. Which is a version of, you know, your boy, maybe that's a way a leader can actually help people do the right thing. And so I'm with you. I wish I could argue with you. So it'd be more interesting debate, but I don't think so.
Well, and related to that, I have done a lot of work in the last year or so with situations where a baby boomer is selling a reasonably successful business. It's a business they built, and maybe they even bought it from another generation, but nonetheless, they're at a stage they want to exit, so they're putting it on the market, and young aspiring entrepreneurs are showing up to buy and invest. And during that transition, and that's the work I do, is helping during that transition of onboarding the new owner. What we often find is a hidden nugget of gold that we can leverage and really make good of is talking about ideas with the staff that exists. And more often than not, the new owner can observe something and say, you know, what if that thing there was different? And some of the staff would jump on it and say, "I've been wanting to do that for a long time." Yeah. And there's this immediate buy-in on the level of trust with the new owner and that kind of opportunity. So to me, that ratifies and puts another checkbox on that idea of good people want to do the right thing.
Absolutely. It also says a little bit about, to your point, the command and control. That's not a command and control person that came in. And, you know, everybody I talk to in all my training, you know, the good leaders ask questions over and over and over. You know, the really good ones know they don't know everything or don't know what is in Doug Thorpe's head right now. So I should ask, you know, but that's a perfect example. Hey, what if we redo the way that's done? Oh, no one's ever asked me. You know, thank you. And then you unleash that team. It also, I think there's even, you know, scientific data that you start asking questions like that, people's brain synapses start connecting and you actually build more creativity and innovation. I don't disagree with you. And I think the key there is the person, the leader asked questions.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And I just recorded another show this morning and we spent quite a bit of time talking about the key word curious. You know, be a curious leader, not judgmental, but one that in the process of asking the questions, it's not to judge, but it's to be curious and explore those other possibilities and maybe newer, better ways to get things done.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I call it same thing, but listen to learn, you know, so, you know, if you're always asking and listening, to try to understand where's that person coming from? What do they know that I don't know? And remembering you don't know at all, it can be very powerful, which is all a sign of your point, curiosity. I had a mentor for many years who used to say, and consulting, not to talk too much about consulting, but that is by definition, a curious business, right? We need to understand and learn and what else could be and how could it be. At a mentor who used to say, "Joe, always engage the skeptics and uncover the no's. And don't don't think the noologists are just saying no to be a pain in the neck. Usually they know something you don't know about why it won't work. And it could be something very simple. It could be something very hard. Until you learn what those no's are, you're not going to be successful in whatever you're driving because something's going to block you. And so it's a version of curious, but it's also, you know, it's your non-command control leader who's actually willing to be curious and willing to ask people. I think the other powerful thing is if you really, if you really ask that of people outside of your normal circle, right? You know, you don't want to be the leader stuck in your little internal team, but go three or four levels down, go three or four organizations over, departments over, depending how big the company is, and probe. I mean, I talked to Joanne Crevisat, who's CEO of Tapestry, and she said, it frustrates my team sometimes, my core team, but I'll go down three or four people and say, hey, what's going on here really? Because they're not afraid to tell me. They just don't call it like it is. And they're not worried about positioning, you know, all signs of being, you know, using curiosity to really make a difference.
I think that's a great point. And I know in my own run of in the corporate world, I had an opportunity in my early days to be on a training program. It was a management training program that basically rotated me through all the different departments. And it wasn't as much about learning the technical details of what they were doing, but it was networking with those leaders in each of those departments. And man, that served me well for the next 20 years that I was with. It was in the banking world, and you know, my bank was a high performer. We ultimately merged with Chase, and but that experience, getting to know all those people and constantly connect as the future unfolded, and you know, they moved around and took different jobs in the organization, but I still had that relationship with them and was able to leverage things far down the road. So you're right, being curious and making those kind of connections, I think, is vitally important.
Yeah, and I think, you know, two things. I actually, early on in my career with BCG, went to Australia. And the team I was with at the time said, oh my gosh, but if you leave, I'm not sure we're going to be back here for you. You know, that kind of thing. But the CEO of the company at the time said, Joe, I went to Japan in my early days, and it just broadened the people I knew around the organization, et cetera, and did just what you said. It just enabled you to be more effective. It's also interesting, you know, for the CEOs I spoke with in my book, all of them, it wasn't quite the management, but they all took on roles or were offered roles that wasn't exactly somewhere in the career. It wasn't exactly the role they wanted. You know, it was they'll sideways versus up, but it did the exact same thing you just said. It exposed them to more. It gave them different capabilities. It really broadened the people. And all of them said, hey, and this is part of the not command and control, you know, be humble to take some of those, whether it's, you know, training program or roles that you'd be thinking, no, I'm beyond that role. You're going to learn a lot in it probably, and ultimately benefit your leadership.
Well, I know down here where I live in the Houston area, we're kind of covered up in oil and gas activity, and all the major oil companies, they rotate leaders on a regular basis. Most assignments, it's almost like the military, most assignments only run 2, max 3 years, and then you're asked to consider a move somewhere else, and it may be even in a wholly different line of business. But if you're on the leadership track, that's going to be an expectation that that's how you're going to do it. And that is one of the stated objectives, is to give you that broader experience and understanding of the other parts of the company.
Right. Right. You know, I know that's a tried and true practice. I have a client I've had the last few years, and they move people quite quickly too. I think the difference, the only problem is sometimes you're not there long enough to really deliver or not deliver, you know, and you just get to escape if you're messing up. Now, it's a little different when you're talking about a fast track person that people envision going to, and I think they move almost, not everybody, but they move they move a lot of people, and that sometimes it can be not as good because you don't really get a chance to deliver on something, and which I think can also be, or fail, you know, it's okay to fail sometimes and learn from it. But of course, it's a pretty good practice. I get it.
I agree with you. And there was a caveat that I learned about at one of the big oils. They, you know, if you think about what those companies do, they have these massive, literally billion-dollar infrastructures of, like, for instance, a refinery. Well, that's a huge property, a huge process. It's very, you know, you got to keep it running at capacity to be profitable. And usually the mission that is given the new plant director is don't screw it up.
Well, okay.
And yeah, exactly. That was my reaction.
I guess really? That's good managerial learning.
Don't really? Is that a fair expectation? I mean, what does that even mean? You know, I mean, you can think about it literally, but how unmotivating is that direction, you know, to someone who might be really eager to learn and get in. And yeah, you don't want to be tinkering with the dials and blow something up. I get that part. But thinking about a new leader coming in there and the parting shot is don't screw it up.
Yeah, well, I also, yeah, right. I'm laughing too. So because it also not as really, is a person really learning deeper management skills and leadership skills and delivery skills if all they're doing is maintaining the staff? So you and I won't judge that, but that sounds a little bit unaspirational. Let's say that. Are you still there?
Oh, no, I'm here, but we lost your video somehow.
Oh, it just says, yeah, let me, there. Oh. Is it back?
Yeah, it's back.
I don't know.
Just, strange. All right. Anyway, I'm gonna give a high sign to my editor that we're gonna look at this spot when we get in.
Okay.
But
I was just saying with you that sounds like a safe job, but it doesn't sound like a job that's gonna inspire and grow leaders. You know,
right.
Just not screwing it up.
Right.
You and I both know sometimes, and you don't want to screw up a whole major operation, I get it, but few mistakes are pretty powerful for learning.
They are. And as reality has it, there were plenty of opportunities for deep problem solving, you know, emergency events that happen in those facilities. And
yeah, of course,
you don't want them to happen, but they do because of the nature of the beast and being proactive in your maintenance schedules and all that kind of work is critically important as well. But anyway, not to dig too far in that hole, but
yeah, right.
So when someone has moved into a new role, Joe, and I'm going to frame this as doesn't particularly matter how senior the role may be. What do you think are some of the key ideas they should think about as that new leader of that piece of an organization?
You know, I think the first thing they should think is really get to know what it is they moved into. Get to know their people, but get to know their customers, you know, their clients, whatever that be. And actually, I had a CEO friend, I guess he was a friend, yeah, of course, once, who went to a new company. He spent the first 6 months out in the field. And the corporate people, like, where is he? They're just angry. But he realized the business is out in the field. And that wasn't there every day, but it was. Then he knew all of the retail. He knew all the store managers, knew all the, you know, the people that were out there in the front line. I think the number one thing someone should do is really get to know what it is they're walking into. And that doesn't happen by sitting in your office and having, you know, the number two person tell you. It's by actually the number two person going on the road with you, but it's actually to get out there. I think that is, to understand, you know, what your customers are feeling, what your employees are feeling, you know, if you're in a place with investors, whatever it might be, but that is the most important thing a new person can do.
Yeah.
And actually you mentioned a minute ago, there's always fires somewhere. Even if you get stuck just putting out the fires, you're now not going to have a chance to really learn. Because once you get to that day-to-day, I mean, you and I both know in a leader, someone once said when I was running North America, they said, what's your job? I said, feels like it's to make all the little decisions that no one wants to make. So they just keep coming up and up and up till someone says, well, Joe, you decide. Why am I deciding this? But nobody wanted to make it along the way. But they're not the decisions that are fundamentally going to change an organization. That's my main counsel. That if I look at over the years, and even when I changed, when I moved to the West Coast, I talked to every partner, every principal, tried to talk to our client. I just was out there. People, what are you doing? I said, well, they're the action, not me. You know?
Yeah, I like that. And it is, and what comes to my mind is, if you're a leader who has that kind of grounding in the business, how powerful is that? You know, when you do go back to the headquarters and sit in your office there, and things come at you, you've got such a great foundation of going, well, that's not going to work in Des Moines. I know that's not going to work, you know, because I was there.
Yeah. And or you have, as you said, in your manager program, you had the network to actually go tap into somebody and say, hey, how do I get this done in Des Moines? You call them up and they'll pick up the phone and not be nervous that the boss, quote unquote, is calling, you know, because they've met them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've had that connection. Well, one other area I don't want to ignore is a popular buzzword that's running around, making its rounds, is the idea of culture. You know, what's my company culture, or how do I change the culture here? Any observations, in your background and experience, what's happening with the notion of creating culture in companies?
I guess I'd have two thoughts. First thought, you know, when you talked earlier about somebody going into a new company, I thought you might've gone a different place. But I think a lot of the starting point, if you're coming, you know, what is the culture that's in a place today? There is a culture. And, you know, if you're lucky, I'll mention P&G because, you know, those two founders, well, now, I guess now 100 plus years ago, set a culture that was very clear and lasted for 100 years. Now, it was a high values culture. It was, you know, create exceptional products for the consumer, you know, and be sold to the retail. It was just a very clear culture. If, you know, the first thing I do is really understand what you've got. If you need to move it, well, then a couple of things. One, you better decide what your own values are and what you're trying to do, you know? I mean, there's a fellow, this guy named Samir Bodis, who's CEO of Icertis. Got out of Wharton, went right to Microsoft. And he says, he just thought the whole world was numbers, deliver, boom, boom, boom. You know, pretty old, your old command control. And he said, then I had to go change it. I left Microsoft and I took over a company. I was going to turn it around. And we had a culture of not being clear with the customers, not delivering on time, you know, just all these things. And we had a culture of hiding it. And he said, I had to blow that up because I couldn't turn this thing around without openness, honesty, frankness. So we started inside and then we went out to all our customers and laid out where we're stuck and where we're not. He said, it was just very powerful. And I think first thing is he role modeled it. You know, he probably insisted on it, I'm sure. He actually role modeled by talking even to customers. And then if you need to, you know, you figure out what kind of metrics you put in place. I mean, not to toot BCG's horn, but BCG cares very much as a senior person that the revenue you deliver and, interestingly, how you're building the teams. And we have 360 feedback that's anonymous. So that could be pretty tough, but it's upward too, even at my level. And we celebrate the North Star Award is the highest commercial and the highest rated upward feedback people. Those are the stars of BCG. And you might think, oh, it's just a commercial, but it's just another example of the command and control is done. No, you've got to be commercial and you've got to grow the team. And if you break the team multiple years in a row, it's not pleasant. Let me say that. Yeah. So there are different tools one can use also to create a culture, but it depends on how big the company is. It depends on how deep the culture is, not the one you want. It's not very easy to change cultures. Yeah. But if you don't start with you, there's no chance.
Yeah. Well, I've been inspired by one of my prior guests on the show when we were talking about culture. They wrote a book and created an analogy to what happens on a farm is similar to what it means to grow a culture. You don't build a culture, you grow a culture. And I thought, well, that's a really interesting way to put it. And we had a wonderful discussion about that. And it did make sense to me. And as I started thinking about situations where I've been involved with leaders who hire me and other coaches to come in and help change a culture, you can't just programmatically define culture. You can't say, here's the 10 boxes to check and poof, we're going to have a new culture. Because, and to your point on these acquisition companies, you're right. There is a culture, whether it's a good one or a bad one, there is a culture. You got something when you land. And if you do have a vision of doing something to change it, make it more dynamic, make it more maybe customer friendly or whatever, it's a process to change that mindset and inspire to be able to grow, not build.
Yeah. No, it's interesting when you say, I agree with the word grow. It's a good word because you're not, it doesn't build, but it also says that you really need, as we said, you know, make, like, I like your example, the new leader comes in and says, hey, why don't we try, you know, the question. But also there are going to be times, I imagine, where, you know, one, you'll grow the people into the culture and you may have to grow new people. Let me put it that way. You know, there may be some that, hey, this is the way we always did it and they ain't going to change.
Right.
And if it's counter to your culture, you know, you've got to make moves. I don't think
that's the,
you know,
yeah, that's the decision.
I don't want to be harsh, but you got to do that. You know, if you're going to grow something, no. I mean, what do you do with a field? You know, you're always culling it and tilling it and using this one and using that one and, you know, ripping out the weeds.
Right. Absolutely. Well, Joe, one last question. You've alluded to your book. Tell us more about the book, the title, and your story on getting it together.
Yeah, so written a book called The Generous Leader, 7 Ways to Give of Yourself for Everyone's Gain. It's exactly about what we've been talking about. You know, you still need to be a successful outcomes-oriented leader, getting the numbers, having visions, but the times and the people today are expecting that leader to also be connected to them personally and deeply, you know, ask questions, understand, help motivate, inspire them, develop them in different ways. So that's it. It's got 7 traits that I think people can push. It's got a lot of how-tos. I'm a practical guy. I'm not a theoretical consultant. I'm a retail consultant. So there's a lot of interesting how-tos. It was never written a book. It's quite a journey. It was
for sure.
It was hard, but it was, you know, when you're finished, it's great. It comes out April 9th. If someone wants to read it, that'd be wonderful. Actually, I don't care if people buy it. I care if people read it, because actually what I really care about is the conversation you and I had, making more leaders a generous leader or a curious leader or, you know, whatever word we want to use. I just think, and that ripples through society. And, you know, we could talk about our country now where people need to maybe take the perspective of each other a little bit more. They can disagree, but at least understand where the other person's coming from.
Totally.
You know?
Very good. Well, Joe, thank you so much for sitting in and sharing this with us. It's really been a pleasure meeting you and talking here. So,
well, thank you, Doug. It was great. I really enjoyed it.
And with that, folks, I do want to remind you, we're going to have links in the show notes for information about Joe and his book. If you want to get a hold of him and learn more, it will be in the show notes. So please check that out. Don't overlook them. And if you're listening on your favorite streaming service, I do like to remind you, we've got a video version of this over on YouTube, channel by the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. Hop over there, check out the archive and leave us a note and let me know if you've got an idea for a future show. So I think we're about done. And with that, we're going to say goodbye, put a wrap on it, and go out there, make it a great day.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.